Mark chapter 11, verse 15. So they came to Jerusalem. Then Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. Then he taught them, saying, John chapter 2, verse 14. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said, this morning I want to talk about protesting like Jesus. Father, let the words of my mouth, the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight and available with clarity to your people. To the end, God, that we would be made doers of the word and not hearers only. Take preparation and transform it into preaching by your power, that we who have gathered might see you more clearly, love you more dearly, and follow you more nearly. This is our prayer in Jesus' name. Bless us, that we might bless you and bless others. Speak now, Lord, your servants hear. In Jesus' name. Happy Sunday. Today marks the 8th anniversary of my assuming pastoral duties here at the Jerusalem Baptist Church. And because it is the first Sunday in June, it would also have marked our annual Men's Day celebration. If the Lord delays his return, there will be plenty of time for us to celebrate anniversaries and annual days. But today there is a more urgent call, that I want to acknowledge. Recent events in our country, indeed in our world, call for a poignant and prophetic word, and I've been wrestling with God all week. Much has been said of the civil unrest sparked by the callous murder of Mr. George Floyd at the hands of a thug police officer who knelt on Mr. Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. While Mr. Floyd lay on his stomach in the Minneapolis streets, fighting for breath. The authorities did not charge or arrest the thug officer or his accomplices until after massive protests rocked this nation to her core. Initially, the local prosecutor conspired with the coroner in order to claim that Mr. Floyd died due to underlying medical conditions and the presence of drugs in his system. When that malicious lie was proven to be false, the local prosecutor continued to fumble the ball in bringing charges. Eventually, the governor moved to appoint the state attorney general to prosecute the case. The state AG moved quickly to arrest and charge the thug officer and his henchmen, but not before protests had spread around the world. One of the most disconcerting aspects surrounding the protest is the claim made by some Christians, mostly white American evangelical Christians, that protest itself is not Christian, that resisting people and systems and spiritual wickedness in high places has no pedigree. Particularly ironic is that the vast majority of the evangelicals who raise these ostensibly Christian objectives to protest self-identify as Protestants. Sit with that for a moment. At the root of the protests that we have recently witnessed is the fact that yet another black citizen was murdered under the guise of law and order. Countless black citizens have been harassed, assaulted, and yes, murdered in the name of law and order. Driving while black. Meeting at a Starbucks while black. Sleeping in the common area of your dorm while black. Sitting in a hotel lobby while black. Walking through the park while black. People. All people, all people of goodwill, are protesting a system of law and order that is itself lawless and disordered. A system under which justice has become just us. People the world over are protesting, demanding that the broken, racist apparatus of American justice be fixed before another black citizen is murdered. And I know some folk are uncomfortable with the emphasis placed on black lives. But what really ought to make us uncomfortable is the fact that black lives have been singled out for state-sponsored murder. Since black lives are being snuffed out, black lives are the lives we're focusing on. Listen, all houses matter, but the fire department only hoses down the house in the neighborhood that's on fire. And if the fire department spends its time hosing down houses that are not on fire, while allowing the house that is on fire to burn, eventually, all houses in the neighborhood are lost. You don't distract the lifeguard who is saving a drowning child by pointing out, wait a minute, Miss Lifeguard, before you jump in the pool to save drowning Daryl, I just want you to know that my child who's sitting over there on the swings, that his life matters too. So don't be stupid. Yes, your child's life matters, but he's sitting peacefully on the swings in absolutely no danger while you are interrupting life-saving activities. Have several seats. Listen, protest is necessary in human endeavor because of the depravity of the human heart. Can I state it theologically? Protest is necessary because of sin. Protest calls the attention of the sinner to his or her sin and demands that the sinner change his or her ways. Indeed, the gospel of Jesus Christ is itself a protest. We'll come back to it later. Protest is necessary at all levels of human endeavor because of our sin nature. Over time, the systems that we humans create always devolve to the detriment of our sisters and brothers who live on the margins. Just consider the last 800 years of human history. When the English crown relentlessly oppressed her subjects, the Magna Carta was written following protest. When the Catholic Church oppressed their priests and people, the Reformation was born in protest. When Wesleyan racism would not allow black parishioners to kneel in prayer on the main level of the St. George's Church in Philadelphia before they had to proceed to the Negro section in the balcony. The AME Church was founded in protest. If anybody knows about protest, it's Protestant Christians. For Protestants to take an anti-protest stance is wholly disingenuous. In fact, it is wholly rooted in racism. With slavery as the order of the day among many white Baptists and abolition as the official position of the Baptist Church in America, slaveholding Baptists and their allies formed the Southern Baptist Church in protest. Protest is necessary. Protest is a part of human endeavor. Come here, Frederick Douglass. Power concedes nothing without demand. Protest is biblical. Protest is so biblical, in fact, that each of the four Gospels records Jesus himself as the chief protester of a corrupted temple system that took advantage of the marginalized of his day. Jesus protested, y'all. And if Jesus protested, shouldn't we, followers of Christ, follow his example? This morning, I want to suggest that we do just that, that we protest like Jesus. The story of Jesus' protest is so important to developing an appropriate theology of protest that each of the four Gospels tells the story. Matthew in chapter 21. Mark in chapter 11. Luke in chapter 19. John in chapter 2. This morning I want to focus on Mark's version of the story with a little help from John. Mark, who recorded the story first, gives the most detailed account of the events. But John's version, which paints Jesus as using a whip as part of his protest, deserves special attention as we explore the concept of protesting like Jesus. Review of the gospel accounts of Jesus' protest calls our attention to three characteristics that I believe we ought to emulate if we would protest like Jesus. Join me in the pages of the Bible as we discover together that Jesus' protest was, number one, confrontational. Number two, it was circumscribed. And number three, it was comprehensive. What I mean to suggest this morning is this: if we would protest like Jesus, protest rightly and righteously, we must protest in such a way that our actions are likewise confrontational, circumscribed, and comprehensive. Our protests ought to be confrontational in that they directly combat systems of injustice. Our protest ought to be circumscribed in that it is narrowly tailored to achieve its goal with minimal collateral damage. And our protest ought to be comprehensive in that the goal of our protest, the ultimate goal, ought to be the healing of both the oppressed and the oppressor. Here again, the words of Mark. So they came to Jerusalem. Then Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple, overturned the table of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. Hear the words of Mark and recall John's observation in John chapter 2, 15, that Jesus wielded a whip as he protested. If we're going to talk about protesting like Jesus, the first question that deserves our attention is this: what is Jesus protesting when he cleanses the temple? review of the gospel narratives that lead us to the episode in the temple reveals that Jesus is protesting entrenched systems that work to the disadvantage of the marginalized. Specifically, in this instance in our text, it's a system put in place by money changers and dove sellers with the endorsement and support of religious authorities. Yes, my dear white American evangelicals, if the hermeneutic fits, wear it. The money changers and the dove sellers, along with the evangelicals of their day, had conspired to take advantage of the pilgrims who came to purchase sacrificial animals and related items on temple grounds. They conspired to jack up the prices and to cheat the people on the exchange rate. I believe that's why Mark highlights for us the sellers of doves, because doves were the poor people's sacrificial animal. A dove was all that a poor person could afford. They couldn't afford oxen and sheep, but they could buy a little dove to make the offering required by the law. And in those times, biblical times, single women, divorced, widowed, or otherwise without a male sponsor, women were the poorest of the poor. Jesus protested a layered, polyvalent system of entrenched evil that operated to the detriment of the marginalized and that operated, watch this, with the endorsement and the support of religious folk. That's what Jesus is protesting. Two groups specifically mentioned in the text, the money changers and the sellers of doves. The money changers took advantage of those who came to worship in the temple by using an unfair exchange rate. In those days, buying and selling in the temple required the use of coins that did not bear the image of Caesar. Because Caesar was a Roman god, lowercase g, the use of coins bearing his image, and all Roman coins at the time bore his image, the use of coins bearing Caesar's image was a violation of Jewish law. So pilgrims who came to the temple in Jerusalem had to use Roman coins in their travel to get to Jerusalem. But then they would have to exchange those Roman coins for approved Jewish coins in order to transact temple business, in order to purchase doves and oxen and sheep and other sacrificial items. They had to exchange their Roman coins for approved Jewish coins. Now, got to understand that the exchange of coinage is based on the weight of the coin. To keep it simple, let's assume we're dealing with gold coins. And let's say that a 5-ounce Roman coin was worth $25. Rather than pricing a 5-ounce temple coin at $25, which would have been an equal exchange rate, if it's 5 ounces of gold, it's worth $25. But rather than pricing the 5-ounce temple coin at $25 plus a little extra to make a reasonable profit, the money changers were cheating the pilgrims by taking a Roman coin worth, say, $25 and only giving the pilgrim, hypothetically speaking, $10 or $15 in temple coins. They got lighter weight temple coins in exchange for their Roman coins. Imagine trying to purchase $150 worth of sacrificial items. What should have cost 6 Roman coins would actually cost 10 to 15 temple coins. It was highway robbery. The money changers gave $150 to the pilgrim, but the money changers actually took in $250 on the transaction. Now let's be clear. Making a profit on exchanging money wasn't the real problem. The problem was that the system took unfair advantage of the pilgrims. And notice, this enterprise was only possible because the religious authorities, the evangelicals of that day, did not care what happened to the poor. The money changers profited from an unjust system, and Jesus wasn't having it. That's why Jesus led a protest. And the silent evangelicals who benefited from the system said nothing about systematic injustice until after Jesus protested. I can hear the evangelicals of that day claiming that they needed an orderly system for transacting business in the temple according to the law. You see, law and order has long been a cover-up used by evangelicals to promote an agenda that works to the detriment of the marginalized, and Jesus protests that. A similar situation obtained with regard to those who sold doves and the other sacrificial animals. Again, I think Mark has us look at doves because doves were the poor person's sacrifice. Those who could not afford bulls and rams and oxens had to use doves, and there was a bustling market at the temple for the purchase of sacrificial animals, mostly because the pilgrims who came to the temple often had to come from great distance. Even if a pilgrim had money, he or she couldn't drag a dove or some other animal on a cross-country trip that might take days. Pilgrims had to purchase their sacrificial animals at the temple complex as a matter of practicality. The dove sellers and the rest had a near captive audience, and they took advantage of that audience by jacking up the price. And remember now, the problem of their price gouging for animal purchases was compounded because of the exorbitant exchange rate used by the money sellers. Imagine a poor widow from out of town who makes it to the temple only to discover that the $10 in Roman coins in her pocket is only worth $3 in temple money. And further, that a $2 dove at home cost $8 at the temple. I want you to see that it was a racket. The money changers and the dove sellers had developed an unjust system with the consent of the evangelicals, and that's why Jesus protested. Watch Jesus. Let Mark's live stream play out on the HD screen of your sanctified imagination. Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. I want you to see here that Jesus' protest was confrontational. The text is clear. Jesus turned stuff over. In fact, Jesus turned it all the way out, and he refused to allow the participants to continue operating their unjust system. Listen, if that ain't a protest, I don't know what protest is. Jesus is not only the Prince of Peace. I want you to see in the text that Jesus is the Prince of Protest. Protest of unjust systems is biblical. So biblical, in fact, that Jesus himself did it. Protest, confrontational protest, complete, John says, with a whip. Listen, entrenched evil does not give up without confrontation. Again, the words of Frederick Douglass ring true. Power concedes nothing without demand. Protest is the means by which demands are levied. There were no arrests in the Floyd murder case until there was protest. The Minneapolis Police Department did not ban chokeholds until there was protest. Roger Goodell did not backtrack on the NFL's racist position regarding Kaepernick-inspired kneeling until there was confrontational protest. Watch the text. Jesus has been preaching and teaching and performing miracles prior to cleansing the temple. But the establishment, along with evangelical support, was bound and determined to sit idly by as the money changers and the dove sellers and their allies fleeced the people. The whole system and its supporters was rotten. So Jesus stopped talking. Jesus stopped teaching. Jesus stopped sending letters. Jesus stopped posting on social media, stopped taking the knee. And instead, Jesus took a whip and confronted those who feigned deafness at his previous polite, long-suffering discourse. So you see, confrontation was necessary to get the ball rolling, to shock the conscience of those who were committed, complicit, and or complacent in the unjust system that oppressed others. And yet, as we live stream Jesus' protest, I wouldn't want us to miss the truth that the confrontational nature of the protest that Jesus initiated was also circumscribed.